Previously on Beta.
Hey, you old scroungy old alley cat. Get out of them garbage cans, ha ha.
Boop-a-doop, 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 boop-a-doop.
I think you made a simply wonderful selection.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Guy Branum is a stand-up comedian. You might have seen him on The Nightly Show with Larry Wilmore or on Chelsea Lately.
You guys may have noticed that I'm unusually large for a homosexual. I am not certain why this is the case. My current working theory is that once my parents realized I was going to be gay, they figured they might as well raise the largest one in the county. If they're not getting grandchildren out of the deal, at least they could get a blue ribbon.
He joins us to talk about his journey into comedy. And we'll talk about matters of taste. You may think that there are only two kinds of taste, good and bad. And you, of course, have good taste, or else you wouldn't be listening to Beta. But there is a whole range of tastes that have a direct connection with our taste buds.
You know, you can basically say that there are sweet books and sour movies and salty songs and bitter poetry and umami documentaries.
A documentary about umami? I've got to see that. Wait, that's not what he meant. He is Benjamin Arrett, and he'll join us to share his grand unified theory of taste. It could change the way you consume your entertainment. But first up, I guess all the trouble started with Megan Abbott. Megan has made a name for herself as a writer of women-centered crime fiction. She is also a staff writer for the HBO series, The Deuce. She joined us to talk about writing for the gritty crime drama and her novel, Give Me Your Head.
I guess I always knew in some subterranean way Diane and I would end up back together. We are bound, ankle to ankle, a monstrous three-legged race, accidental accomplices, wary conspirators, or Siamese twins fused in some hidden place. It's that powerful, this thing we share. A murky history, its narrative near impenetrable. We keep telling it to ourselves, noting its twists and turns, trying to make sense of it, and hiding it from everyone else. Sometimes it feels like Diane was a quarter of myself broken off and left to roam my body, floating through my blood. On occasional nights, stumbling to the bathroom after a bad dream, a Diane dream, I avoid the mirror, averting my eyes, leaving the light off, some primitive part of my half-asleep brain, certain that if I looked, she might be there. Cover your mirrors after dark, my great-grandma used to say, or they trap the dreamer's wandering soul. So even though I haven't seen her in a dozen years, it isn't truly a surprise when Diane appears at the Severn Lab, my workplace, the building in which I spend most of my waking life. Of all the labs in all the world, she had to walk into mine, and everything begins again. The strangest part is how little we actually know about each other. Not our birthdays, our favorite songs, who made our hearts beat faster or didn't. We were friends, if Diane is friends with anyone, only for a few months and long ago. But we do know the one thing no one else in the world knows about the other. The only important thing.
That was excellent. Thank you. And I love that Casablanca reference. That's funny off all the labs in the world. Yeah. The title of your novel, Give Me Your Hand, made me think of that opening scene in Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo in which Jimmy Stewart's character, Scotty Ferguson, is hanging off the edge of a roof and the police officer reaches out and says, "Give me your hand," not once but twice.
Give me your hand!
So I'm wondering, is the title by any chance a reference to Vertigo?
Oh, that's amazing, because actually it's not, but that movie was hovering through my head through much of the writing of this book. So maybe unconsciously. Consciously, it comes from Macbeth. Lady Macbeth says it during one of her soliloquies.
Yeah. So, and Vertigo, is it possible to say about how Vertigo influenced influenced your novel without giving anything away?
Yeah, I think it's something about the sort of dreamlike structure of that movie, that it's sort of about obsession and about the past haunting one. And, you know, it's sort of a crazy movie, really, if you look at it. You know,
oh, yeah.
It's about, you know, yeah. Jimmy Stewart's pretty dangerous person, but he's the hero. I think also that kind of aesthetic, that it's okay to have kind of damaged heroes at the center of the book and, you know, all of that.
Yeah, because he really goes off the rails near the end of the film.
Right,
kind of really
right.
unhinged and almost like sociopathic, almost psychopathic in places. Yeah, so can you give us a brief synopsis of Give Me Your Hand without, of course, revealing any major spoilers?
Or, sure.
Yeah.
Sure, yeah. It's about Kit, who is a, you know, a sort of ambitious young scientist, and she's about to go into competition for a slot on this big study she wants to be a part of, and just coming into frame is her, as Diane, a girl she knew in high school who actually originally fired up her ambition, but who also shared with her a very dark secret that's haunted Kit ever since. And so now they're sort of competitors or rivals in this lab, and the past, as it does, comes back to haunt them.
Yeah, yeah. And this big study is about PMDD, premenstrual dysphoric disorder. Why were you interested in writing about that?
I wanted it to be some women's health issue because I was interested in women in the sciences are still so underrepresented, and women's health issues are still under-researched and underfunded. So I wanted it to be something in that area. Then I came upon PMDD and was sort of amazed at how many women suffered from it, you know, I guess up to 8%, maybe more, but how little I had never heard of it.
Me neither.
So that's a large number of women, and that they were sort of suffering in silence was very compelling to me and made me want to look closer.
Yeah, and also it's been used as a criminal defense, right? So I guess that was something that appealed to you as well?
Yes, I mean, it's sort of a not successfully, I'll add, but it is interesting because I think that in some ways PMDD is sort of stigmatized in part because it's a women's health issue and it's private and personal, but also because it feeds into various stereotypes of women being sort of out of control and their emotions overtake them, and I think that's how it ended up becoming this criminal defense. But all of that was interesting to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, one of the great things about your book is the way you portray women's friendships. This idea of frenemies is such a huge part of the relationship between Kit and Diane. How were you able to write about this so well?
I think women have so many, and I suspect men do too, but maybe women more common. Women, I suppose, are trained, socialized not to show their competitive instincts as openly. So I think there are often these relationships among women that are part friendship, part competitive relationships, part, you know, somehow you feel sort of neck and neck with each other. And we don't talk about it that much, but it kind of drives us. And so I kind of wanted to get into it and sort of look at it from the inside out.
Mm. Yeah, and you've never worked in a lab, have you? Because you write so well about it, I kind of wondered, hey, has Megan worked in a lab? But you haven't,
no,
I don't think, have you?
No, not at all. And I really started at square one with the research. I've worked in environments where I'm the only woman before, but never a lab. And I talked to a number of female scientists, and to such a degree, I knew so little that I actually had to ask them what they did all day. And it was very embarrassing because, of course, they do a lot. But I really love research. And so all of that, the world of the lab, the competition, this sort of being in that cloistered hothouse space together just really compelled me.
Mm. There's this incredibly strong narrative propulsion to Give Me Your Hand. The pacing is like incredible. It literally is a page turner because I found myself, you know, reading as fast as possible because I wanted to find out what was going to happen next as soon as possible. And the twists and turns in your plot, they kind of reminded me of Ira Levin's novel, A Kiss Before Dying. Is that a book you're familiar with?
I have not read that in years, but I was reading Ira Levin. This is amazing. Well, I was reading Rosemary's Baby, actually. Which is the same kind of breakneck pacing, and the movie's very faithful adaptation. So he is, I think, a master in that. Not talked about as much these days, but I think he understood something about what keeps the heart going, how much information you need and how much you don't need, and how to sort of nudge the reader along into their own unconscious spaces.
Yeah, which are things that you do so well, too. Yeah. You're also working as a staff writer on David Simon and George Pelicanos's HBO series, The Deuce. And this series is set in and around Times Square during the early 1970s. And the show chronicles the legalization of pornography and the rise of the pornography industrial complex. Working on the show must be quite a different experience from the solitary work of a novelist. Can you talk a bit about the differences?
Yes, it's really quite opposite. It was a big adjustment for me. You know, I mostly just sit by myself all day at my computer, and I can do whatever I want.
Yeah. But
in this case, you know, walking into that writer's room, it's, you know, this sort of conference room with a, you know, David Simon, George Pelicanos, Richard Price, these big guns, you know, and heroes to me, really, and sort of talking and plotting and arguing all day long was, I would get a headache by the end of the day. It was exhilarating, but very, very different, and it forced me out of my shell. I had intended to hang back at first and just observe, and they did not let me do that.
Yeah. You're one of three women writers working on The Deuce, right? Is that right?
Yes. We've had Lisa Lutz, who's another crime novelist, and we'll also have one, you know, we have a few up-and-coming writers who've been just sort of wonderful. It is in large part about the women working in pornography, so it was really important to David and George that female voices be represented in the room.
Yeah, and if I'm not mistaken, David Simon reached out directly to you, right? Is that right?
Yes, I knew him a little bit through his wife, Laura Lippman, who's a very famous crime novelist in her own right, and I knew George a little bit from the crime fiction community, which is very tight, but it was a big leap for me and a big leap of faith for him that I could pull it off, and, you know, it's been an exciting transition, but definitely one that's sort of made me call on all kinds of resources inside.
Yeah. What do you think that you in particular are contributing to the voice and tone of the show, of The Deuce?
I think one of the things that both Lisa and I, who were the first women brought in, our mission was that the women be a range of reflect a range of experiences, that not all women feel degraded by pornography, and not all women see it as something they should be ashamed of, and some will, and some will have positive and negative experiences. We wanted to have, you know, them have multiplicity of responses to working in that world, and we also wanted them not just to be victims, but some of them are, you know, behave badly themselves, mm-hmm. and make poor choices, and we wanted all of that.
Yeah, they're not just passive, they're active.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
You wrote the penultimate episode of the first season, and this is really where The Deuce's co-creator, George Pelicanos, made his name with The Wire. He was the guy who wrote the penultimate episode of each season. The episode of The Deuce that you wrote is called Au Reservoir. Can you give us a brief outline of what happens in this episode?
Yeah, it's really, and this to avoid spoilers, but it's a big transition episode. It is the George episode, and he's never let me forget that he let me do it. I don't think it's ever going to happen again. But
was that extra, just to get on that for a second, was that extra pressure, that the fact that it was, you were writing the episode he would normally write?
Yeah. Yes, it was enormously so. And I worried over it for endlessly while writing it. But it was a really, you know, exciting one, and I had pitched a lot of ideas for it. It's a moment of transition where one of the characters that we've grown to really care about, you know, it gets out of the world, and that was really important.
You going back to Cece? Where to then? I mean, now that Frankie Martino isn't going to build you a little white farmhouse on the banks of the Hudson River. What's the plan?
I'm not going back to West Virginia.
I got a sister who lives up near Buffalo, Lackawanna. You ever visit her before?
Mm-mm.
Why not?
Lackawanna.
And so all of that felt very monumental and important, and I wanted to get it right. I knew I would be in safe hands with David Simon overseeing it and ultimately, you know, making sure it was in tip-top shape. But it was nerve-wracking. I had to kind of pretend that it wasn't really ever going to make it to air. You know,
like, yeah, to take some of the pressure off. But yeah. Is there anything that you can tell us about season two of The Deuce?
Yeah, it's well underway, actually, and we move forward to 1977-78, so it's sort of the golden moment of porno chic, and we're really going to see the heyday of all that, and so that's very exciting. But most of the characters will be back, and this is really the kind of splendor of porn when it really felt. This is like right at that sort of pivotal moment before video comes in and tromps down on everything.
Yeah. So. All right. We'll look forward to that. So have you learned anything from writing for television that you're now applying to writing your fiction?
You know, that's always a slippery slope. Richard Price always giving me advice about that, having gone back and forth between the two. You know, there are really very different notions of storytelling beyond the collaborative. There's something very intimate about novels, and you really can get in the reader's head in a way that TV would never have. On the other hand, I can't say I haven't brought some of the pacing elements back into novels. I'm much more aware early on of when things are moving too slowly because you have no time for that on TV.
Yeah.
You have such a limited amount of space.
Give Me Your Hand must have been an option for a film by now, right?
It's an option for TV, AMC, which is, as a Mad Men and Breaking Bad lover, I'm thrilled that it's in AMC's hands now.
Megan Abbott is the author of Give Me Your Hand and a writer for the HBO series The Deuce. You can find out more about Megan at wpr.org/beta. And let us know your comments, questions, and even your favorite Megan Abbott novel by sending a note to beta@wpr.org.
When I was on Chelsea Lately, there were always gay guys who were posting like, oh, he should not be the gay guy on Chelsea Lately. He's not like me. He's fat. Or he's not like me. He sounds super gay.
Comedian Guy Branum joins us next. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta. Guy Branum is a stand-up comedian. You might have seen him on Chelsea Lately, At Midnight, and The Nightly Show with Larry Wilmore. He also hosts Talk Show The Game Show on True TV. And now Guy is an author. His book is called My Life as a Goddess, a memoir through unpopular culture. The title comes from Greek mythology.
It's a not often told story from Greek mythology about Leto, the mother of Apollo and Artemis, forgetting that she was a goddess, then remembering, then sort of doing something, like being able to work a miracle to sort of get back at some people who she was pissed off at. I tell that story a lot to friends, to myself, because the version of it I read, there's this moment where the author wrote, and then she remembered she was a goddess. And for me, life has been sort of like a long series of events where I end up feeling kind of powerless or alone or not able to really do anything to fix my situation. And then I remembered that I was a goddess, and I couldn't necessarily fix my situation, but I could at least make some trouble.
Yeah.
You know, even if I wasn't making it rain or turning people into frogs, I was at least doing something to take some control of the world around me back.
Yeah, some agency. And as you say, as you write in your book, you say that was that sentence, then she remembered that she was a goddess, that was the most beautiful, wonderful sentence you'd ever read. And that story changed you. And you have this great passage about how this story changed you. Could you read it for us, please?
Sure. I'm not supposed to be a goddess. I'm very fat, I'm bald, I have a faggy voice. My family is poor, my parents are uneducated. I dress like a wet 3-year-old. My handwriting is bad, I sweat a lot. My parallel parking is amateurish. I'm wholly devoid of the skills required to make any ball go into any goal, hoop, or pocket. I'm not supposed to like myself, and I'm certainly not supposed to think that I should matter. The world has spent a lot of time telling me that, and in the past 30 years or so, I often listened, because we all listen. The world is mostly full of fine facts and good lessons, but some of the facts and lessons were built to keep you down. and I got kept down for decades. Then I remembered that I was a goddess. I may not always feel like it, but I have powers. I am an amazing dancer. I'm quite ridiculously smart. I'm strong. I'm funny. Babies like me. I have very strong research skills. I make passingly good Punjabi okra. I have a law degree. I sparkle on panel shows. I'm very good at listening when I try. It's not amazing. It's not lightning bolts or control of the seas. I can't turn myself into a swan and have my way with whatever man I like, but it's enough for me. And Doris Gates gave me my most important power, the power to see myself. I can't control what people see when they look at me. Most people see a weird, fat, unsexy guy who is wearing cargo shorts even though he should know better. I can't decide if you think I'm beautiful, but I do get to decide if I'm going to feel beautiful. And from the moment I first tried it, I've been addicted.
That was great. Thank you. And so, that was like Thanks. A really life-changing moment, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I was always kind of a bookish kid, and there have been so many, like, earth-shattering moments that happened in my life that was just me reading a book. And it's kind of hard to write a story about you being changed by art. This book is sort of like about the stories that happened to me, what happened in my life. Look, I made some terrible choices and made some real messes in my actual life. But it's also about sort of the works of art that pushed me into those terrible choices or taught me how to get out of them.
Yeah. As you say, you were a bookish child. And actually, more than that, I would say you describe yourself as having this insatiable intellectual curiosity. So I'm curious, would it be fair to say that your love of ideas and words were a kind of weapon that you could use while you were growing up, use as a kind of survival mechanism?
I think that they were more transportation. Like, I grew up in a very small farm town in rural Northern California. And it's very interesting because, like, I've lived in the Midwest, and I think that farm towns there are different because you have more of a sense of community and you have more of a sense of responsibility because the people of Wisconsin have to run Wisconsin. But when you're in a farm town in California, there's no responsibility. San Francisco and Los Angeles and San Diego are going to be running everything. There's no sense of community. There's, you know, I went to towns in Minnesota and Wisconsin that were tiny, but they had community theaters. They had bands. In Northern California, there was none of that stuff because everybody essentially showed up 6 weeks ago. And so in this place that was like deeply anti-intellectual, very working class, to me, it was just amazing that there was sort of like PBS and books and encyclopedias that could, like, show me other places.
Yeah, yeah. You say that gay men fear their own voices and fear other gay men's voices even more. Can you talk a bit about that? Explain what you mean?
Yeah, I mean, gay men mostly look like other men. So it is really our voices, both our physical voices, the sound of our voice, and the things that we say that identify us. And we're used to hiding. That is, for all of our closeted years, it is by hiding. It is by not saying the things that are true to us, by trying to not say them in the voices that are natural to us, that we manage to survive. Because we know that identifying ourselves will make us a target, will make us prey. And so we try to camouflage ourselves. And when you're doing that, having somebody else identify themselves as gay or sort of like present an interpretation of what gay means is very hard because, like, your own experience isn't being expressed. Having somebody express their version of your experience can be even more distasteful in its way.
Yeah. You have this great sentence in that passage in the book, quote, "You fear a voice you cannot control representing your life and your world, but because so much is unsaid, you also hunger for it to be said with grandeur, with plumage," end quote.
Yeah, it's really hard because it's completely true of me myself. Like, so frequently I will watch art about being gay or read a book about being gay, and I'll chafe at it in some way. I'll want to, like, distance myself and say, that's not me. Or, you know, when I'm on television, when I was on Chelsea Lately, there were always gay guys who were posting, like, he should not be the gay guy on Chelsea Lately. He's not like me. He's fat. Or, like, he's not like me. He sounds super gay. That's not what I'm like. Like, I can't blame those people for those reactions because when you don't see other gay people in media, the very infrequent times that it happened, it needs to mean so much to you.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You talk about watching an episode of the TV news magazine show 2020 back in the 1980s, and it was a very specific episode that made you very angry. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, it was. They were teasing to a segment about America's obesity epidemic, and they were showing B-roll of fat people with their faces pixelated or their heads cut off. They were shot mostly shoulder to hip, so that, you know, no one's face had to be associated with their gross fat body. And I remember being very disturbed by that. Like, as a fat kid, and my head was attached to my body all day long, it was sort of implying that it was so embarrassing or dehumanizing to have your head be identified with your fat body that the show wasn't willing to do that. And, you know, I sort of use that as a jumping off point to talk about my relationship to my body, but also the ways that media represents fat people as not really having a personality or ever being good at anything.
Yeah. So talk a bit more about that, if you will, about the kind of message that the media and popular culture have sent to you about being an overweight person.
We see fat people as dumb. We see fat people not as protagonists, but people who are in the way of other more dynamic people who are getting stuff done. And history tells you a very different story. History tells you about scads of fat people who have done lots of amazing things, but we don't really see that, particularly in, like, movies or TV. It's always just that fat burping guy who's at best funny and at worst in the way.
Yeah, so how were you able to overcome popular cultures and the media's dehumanizing portrayal of fat people?
Oh, I haven't. I'm still bound up in it, in a constant state of struggle with myself. But I think remembering that that's the case, that this doesn't have to be a battle, is important to me. So much of what we are told about fat people is that they can only be virtuous by fighting with all of their being to unfat themselves. And I'm not saying that anyone should be unhealthy. I'm not saying that anyone shouldn't manage their health. What I'm saying is that my singular purpose is never going to be destroying my fat body, because it's got to do things for me along the way. I wrote a book. I have other things going on. And behaving as though it must be the only characteristic in one's life and be fought against with the entirety of one's being to be a virtuous fat person is hard, because it means anyone who is fat has to either be telling you the story of their fight or not be fat anymore. Because even if they are telling you the story of their fight, you're still not going to believe it because they're still fat.
Is there one particular stand-up comedy special that you can point to and say, this is the thing that really inspired me to pursue a career in stand-up comedy?
I started watching stand-up during the stand-up boom of the 1980s when I was relatively young. And I remember watching Eddie Murphy's Delirious and just falling in love with his sense of power and agency and swagger. What I did not remember is that the first 5 minutes or so of Eddie Murphy Delirious is him just talking about how disgusting gay people are. And it was a fascinating moment to realize this thing that really did make me fall in love with stand-up, and in many ways defined the style of stand-up that I do today, also was full of homophobic messages that really informed my understanding of myself as a gay man. And it was a really hard process to try to reconcile those two things, to say this piece of art was very valuable to me and very damaging to me at the same time. But Eddie Murphy in a leather suit strutting around that stage and recontextualizing the world made me fall in love with stand-up, and I can never deny that.
Yeah. Have you been able to come to terms with it?
I think when you are a member of a marginalized group, you are used to deeply loving artists and performers and writers who don't want you. Mm. It is an interesting kind of cognitive dissonance, because I think it does, in the long run, let you tell yourself a story about the reasons you don't matter.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, how many women deeply love work by deeply misogynistic artists? How many people of color love works by people from history who wouldn't have considered them to be a person? And figuring out how to reconcile those things, I mean, God knows I don't have the answer, but I think it's an interesting challenge, because those things can't be denied.
Yeah. Yeah, very well said. Yeah. What is the most important thing you learned from Eddie Murphy? Can you point to one thing?
The most important thing I learned from Eddie Murphy was that when you're on stage, you've got answers. They may not always be the right answers, but you've got answers. You've got a worldview. I think one of the things that was appealing about him was at a time when we didn't have a huge number of like iconic Black stand-up comedians. We had a couple. But like he understood that talking about his background could be alienating. So he needed to be doing all of the work of making certain that you were along for the ride, that you understood that like his world was what was important to you. And the most amazing thing about Eddie Murphy's Delirious, the other thing I didn't remember is it's like half biographical stuff and half pop culture stuff. And I hadn't thought about that at all because I only think about the biographical stuff, which really takes you into this experience of growing up in poverty in a large family, in a Black family. But that pop culture stuff is there to remind you that he is not unlike the audience.
Yeah.
And I realize the way that I do that myself.
Yeah, yeah, because it's a common denominator for all of us. So it's a kind of a bonding, a way to bond with your audience.
But yeah.
Yeah, at the same time, though, yeah, what you learned, it sounds like you're saying that you learned, the most important thing you learned from Eddie Murphy is the power of your own perspective, right? This idea that you have, each comedian, each person has their own identity, their own life story. And so that's a way of creating what the advertising guy Ross Reeves called your USP, your unique selling proposition is, you know, you yourself have your own story.
Yeah. My friend Emily Heller, who's a great stand-up comedian, she once said, like, stand-up was the only truly diverse art form she'd ever participated in. And I'd never thought about it that way, but when someone is on stage, it's all them.
Yes.
It's all them.
Yeah.
And that's what's so great about having more voices in stand-up these days, is that it does allow for this diversity and really conversation between voices.
I'm curious to know what you think of Scott Thompson's famous gay character, Buddy Cole, who's having a bit of a resurgence these days. Are you a fan?
Of course I'm a fan of Buddy Cole.
Yeah.
Like, at my, in my little house in Northern California, there was nothing that was at all telling me about real gay life. And then, you know, you had Buddy Cole on a bar stool telling the most, like, jaded and complex and sophisticated story. It was always so funny, but, like, told like an afterthought. Buddy Cole is amazing, and I'm so glad that Scott is doing him some more. I saw him at a show in San Francisco, and he was doing Buddy Cole monologues, like, about stuff that has happened since Kids in the Hall went off the air, and it was just thrilling and delightful to have, like, Buddy's voice back in the world giving his perspective on things.
Yeah.
Because the wonderful thing about Buddy Cole is Buddy Cole was, you know, during a period of time when gay activists were having to ask for and fight for so much, Buddy Cole didn't need anything from you. He was fine. And I think that kind of, like, dignity and pride was something we didn't see a lot of.
In November 2017, you wrote an essay for New York Magazine. This was in the wake of a New York Times article in which five women discussed the sexual harassment and assault that they received from Louis C.K. Can you tell me a bit about what you said in your essay?
Basically, I was just saying the Louis TV show Louis always started with him leaving the Comedy Cellar in New York, and so frequently showed him at the comics table at the Comedy Cellar in New York. And the comics table at the Comedy Cellar, like, the Comedy Cellar is a temple of stand-up comedy in America. And that comics table is so representative of the people who are at the top of our industry. But so frequently when it is represented in media, it is represented as being a place that is only straight men, or only straight men and a token woman. And I was essentially saying that as long as we have these deeply male heterosexual power structures within our business, it's going to be easy for people to do things like what Louis C.K. did. It's going to be, you know, it's also kind of, stand-up comedy is a really unstructured career. So it's not like there's an HR department who you could go to report discrimination or sexual harassment. It really is about us policing each other. And not policing, just sort of like looking out for each other. And having the people in charge be all straight guys means women, trans people, queer people, there's nobody looking out for us, or there aren't enough people looking out for us. And what I said in the piece was essentially, we need to stop behaving as those guys are the end-all and be-all of what stand-up is.
What do you want readers to take away from your book?
My book is fundamentally about my experience. I try to reflect on pop culture. I try to sort of reflect on the larger world. But it's mainly just about how I made it through life and became the flawed and wonderful person that I am. And I hope that when people get done with it, they look at their own lives a little bit differently and they think about the struggles that they have had as powers as much as struggles.
Guy Branum is a stand-up comedian and the author of My Life as a Goddess, a memoir through unpopular culture. You can find out more about Guy at wpr.org/beta.
Going back to the food metaphor, it really helps me think that I don't necessarily like one kind of movie or one kind of culture. I don't just eat steak and mashed potatoes.
What do steak and potatoes have to do with watching a movie? We're not talking about My Dinner with Andre. Or are we? Stay tuned to find out what the heck is going on. I know I'm going to. I have to. I'm contractually obligated to be here. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and you're listening to Beta. Read any bitter books lately? Have you watched any salty television? Listen to any really great umami music? My fellow Canadian Benjamin Arrett is the author of Elements of Taste, Understanding What We Like and Why. And he's come up with a mind-bendingly delicious and nutritious way to figure out what entertainment you should be consuming.
So basically, I was researching taste and how we might be able to make more sense of it. If there might be some way to get beyond good taste, bad taste, highbrow, lowbrow, something that was more sort of useful to people to figure out what they liked and what they should like more of and how they could find more of what they liked. And from that, I found some research about how you can take all of these genres. These researchers looked at a whole bunch of genres on Amazon, on IMDb, at Barnes & Noble, all these sort of genres of books and movies and television shows, and broke them down into something like 110 categories, and then put them in front of a wide range of people, thousands of people, and had them sort of recombine them based on what they liked and how they would sort of categorize these different cultures. And from that, they sort of came up with these five basic categories, which were communal, thrilling, dark, cerebral, and aesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I was looking at this research, which I found fascinating, and I thought, five basic kinds of taste. Wait a minute, we have five basic kinds of taste on the tongue. You have your sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and umami. So maybe there's something there. Basically, I teased this out and pushed this idea to its logical limits and got to the point where I thought, you know, you can basically say that there are sweet books and sour movies and salty songs and bitter poetry and umami documentaries. And you can take things and see how they might recombine all of those things, just as lots of foods are a little bit sweet, a little bit sour, a little bit salty. Same with culture.
Let's explore how some of these literal tastes translate into cultural tastes. For example, sweet. What does it mean to crave sweetness in culture?
So sweetness sort of starts my first taste, because that's the first taste that every child likes. You don't take candy from a baby for a reason. And it's sort of the taste of cultural comfort. It's the taste that tells you everything's going to be okay. Most pop songs are sweet, romantic comedies, sitcoms, sort of things that have happy endings and reassure you. And it's sort of cultural comfort food, like ice cream.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think it is also the prevalent taste in all culture, because often when we turn to entertainment, we don't want to necessarily be challenged. We want to be comforted. Sometimes too much so. Sometimes way too much sweet stuff, and movies always end the way you expect. The hero always wins. So yeah, depending on your taste, but just to know that going in, you're like, of course this is sweet. Just the way they add sugar to spaghetti sauce, they make sure that every movie has a hero who is easy to root for.
Yeah. You say that sweetness, you describe it in terms of culture as the taste of innocence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so when I walk through the five, that is definitely the one you start from. So that's where, you know, of course everything's going to end up fine. That's a very sort of the first thing we're taught, and all kids' storybooks end that way, and on purpose, it's just very reassuring.
Yeah, and as you said, that's what we're looking for in entertainment, to escape the dystopian times in which we live.
Mm-hmm,
often, that's what we're looking for, is some escapism. So if you do like your culture on the sweet side, what kind of music will you like?
I think you can basically turn on the radio and hear just about anything. most pop songs have that sort of sweet note. It's interesting to notice that country music often doesn't. That'll get a little more into the bitter and into sort of the challenges of life. But you listen to, say, Bruno Mars. Most of his songs are very much surface level, very danceable, very hummable. You're not really necessarily engaging with the lyrics, but it makes you want to dance, which is great. I mean, that's what it sets out to do, and that's what it does.
What about a band like Coldplay? Would you consider them to be sweet?
Very sweet, and they're very communal. They really hit that emotional note. People will start crying at a Coldplay concert, but there's no definitive reason why. They're not talking about anything specific. It's just sort of general emotional notes that they're hitting.
Yeah.
So I think that's very sweet. And obviously there's plenty to be said that has been said and is most often said against Coldplay. But the fact is they hit that note really, really well.
Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily a sweetness in the terms of being saccharine and kind of, you know, something treacly and like a Hallmark card. We're not necessarily saying that, right? When you describe them as sweet.
I'm not, but I know that lots of people would.
Yeah. I was just guessing at numbers and figures, pulling the puzzles apart. So, if we look at the opposite of sweet, that is sour. Can you talk about how sour maps onto culture?
Yeah, I'm not sure sweet and sour are opposites. It's interesting how they relate to each other. The way I sort of think about it is that you go from sweet to sour in a natural evolution of taste. Sour is very much a thrilling culture. So just as a kid who gets sick of sweet candy can easily go to sour candy in the same candy store, at the same convenience store, wherever they're buying their candy, you can get Warheads and Sour Patch Kids and that sort of thing. It's not as sort of family-friendly. It's a little bit transgressive, but not really. You're still consuming a lot of glucose fructose. So, yeah, I think the cultural sour note hits that as well. So that's more thrilling culture. I think of Mad Magazine. I think of like roller coaster rides. I think of anything that a parent is not necessarily going to love, and that's what makes it good for like a teenage boy, basically.
Mm-hmm. Is it also, I think, if I recall correctly, sour you also describe as being like the taste of rebellion?
Exactly, yeah. So it's something like, I guess, the Vice Media brand is like perfectly sour. Like,
yeah.
Even though they do documentaries, they do good journalism, but the whole thing that's made it a billion-dollar brand is that it hits this sort of sour note. It's not the kind of news your father is going to watch, your grandfather is going to watch.
Mm-hmm.
It's very much aimed at youth. And to be a youth brand, you basically have to be sour.
Yeah, speaking of sour youth brands, would something like the iconic punk rock band The Sex Pistols, would you consider them sour culture?
Yeah, when you look at rebellion, I mean, punk was all about rebellion. I think what's very interesting about punk is that, you know, it's not really a genre that continues today. I mean, it's obviously permeated into all sorts of different genres, but the ethos of punk, the sort of green mohawk and piercings, et cetera, is, I mean, teenagers still dress like that. So it's like, it's more than just a genre of music. It's sort of a whole ethos that continues.
One of the examples of sour culture that I found very fascinating, because I'd never heard of it before, is something called blarping, which sounds like a sound effect that Don Martin would write in one of his Mad Magazine cartoons, but it's not. What actually is blarping?
So LARPing, of course, is live action role play. So that's, you know, everything from Civil War reenactors to Dungeons and Dragons in real life. LARPing is this sort of hilariously subversive business live action role play. Yeah, most famous sort of LARPer is a Australian teenager who started this entire group on Facebook, where they would just basically circulate inter-office memos and discuss the kind of really boring things that adults discuss in a cubicle situation.
Yeah, and I suspect they were probably quoting from movies like the cult comedy Office Space.
Yeah, you apparently didn't put one of the new cover sheets on your TPS reports.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry about that. I forgot.
Yeah. You see, we're putting the cover sheets on all TPS reports now before they go out. Did you see the memo about this?
Yeah. Yeah, I have the memo right here. I just forgot. But it's not shipping out till tomorrow, so there's no problem.
Yeah.
Why do you think it is important for us to understand what we like and why we like it?
Most immediately, I think we can find more of what we like if we know what we're looking for. That was my primary motive in writing this book. I wanted to be able to understand what it was that I liked and why. And the why is something that was hard to put my finger on, because back in the old days, you could say, well, I like this genre of music and I like these kind of movies. But all of culture is basically mashed up now. There's action movies these days are much smarter than they would have been, say, 20, 30 years ago. TV series are making references and playing off each other. Everything is so interconnected and so much smarter that you can't just pick a genre and think that that's going to do it for you.
Yeah. So has this theory that you've created, this elements of taste, grand unified theory of taste, has this helped you to understand why you like the kinds of culture that you like?
So going back to the food metaphor, it really helps me think that I don't necessarily like one kind of movie or one kind of culture. I don't just eat, you know, steak and mashed potatoes. Different times of day, different moods, different circumstances. You'll want to hear different music. You'll want to watch different movies. You'll want to read different books. I point out that one of the hardest questions that you could possibly ask someone is, what kind of music do you like? Because what do you mean, like at a party, at the gym, on a date, by myself? Cleaning the kitchen, what am I doing when I listen to this music? Or am I at a concert? I think it's important to realize, just as we've had much more range of possible culture to consume, we are much more able to consume all that culture than we have traditionally given ourselves credit for.
As you said, we find different uses for the culture. You say that bitter is the taste of repulsion. So if people like bitter flavors like beer and coffee, does that mean they're going to like Roman Polanski's 1965 psychological horror film, Repulsion? Or am I being too literal here?
Repulsion, a frightening film that takes the everyday world and distorts it, taking you inside the mind of a girl driven to insanity.
I think you're on the right track.
Oh,
I
mean,
Polanski has his own issues, which was probably beyond the scope of this conversation. I think the central idea there is challenging. So these things are repulsive upon first taste. I mean, Polanski might continue to be repulsive. The idea is that you like to challenge yourself with things that are not necessarily easy to like. So coffee and beer are both interesting because they're both such popular beverages, but the first time you taste either of them, you are repulsed. You don't want to have more of that. I mean, if you think of something like kale or broccoli, leafy green vegetables that are very good for you, but they're an acquired taste.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, once you like them, I mean, kale is hugely popular. So once you like them, you really get into them. And then there's a part of it where it's sort of enjoyable to like them because it signifies so much about who you are. I mean, you can go to any independent cafe in any major city and you can see people who are there because they want to be seen there and because they like the coffee they have there.
Yeah. So can you give me an example of a bitter culture, a bitter film, bitter music or something? Or a bitter literature? Bitterature, I guess we might call it. Or maybe not.
You know, one of the like, classic examples is Jonathan Franzen. Because I think a lot of people who write literature that is aiming for something complex and dense have a difficult time when they become sort of universally popular or popular beyond that sort of group of people who they know appreciate exactly what they're doing. So I think of, and this is going back a ways, but I think of when The Corrections came out and Oprah Winfrey picked it for her book club, that was famously very uncomfortable for Franzen because he didn't necessarily want to be picked by Oprah's book club. So it's basically, he's doing something bitter, and then sort of this queen of sweetness picks it, and he doesn't necessarily want to be there. Even though what he was writing is arguably his books managed to combine enough of the elements of taste that they appeal to a lot of people. There's just that walking that walk of doing something artistic that is accessible. For some artists, that's a sign that you're not doing something challenging enough.
Umami has been called the fifth taste. How would you define the taste of umami?
The thing they famously say it's impossible to taste. If you take a bunch of MSG powder and mix it in water and drink it, you don't really taste anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's the kind of thing you add it to something and physically the actual taste is, and it accentuates the flavors. So I map it onto the idea of a cerebral culture, this sort of stuff that has a deep umami ribbon where you sort of taste it or you see it and you think there's so much there and I want to know more about it. Say you're watching a movie and it's the kind of movie where you wish you could take the camera and like tilt it like 20 degrees to the left to see what else is going on in this crazy world. That's what I find is like a really umami culture. I think of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. It's an Amazon Prime show by the Gilmore Girls creator.
Yeah, Amy Sherman Palladino.
She creates this world, whether it's accurate or not, is really beside the point of what like a 1950s New York comedy scene would be like. And you just want to be in that world. And she gives you everything you need to be in there. And the references go fast and that it sort of appeals to that part of our brains that just wants more and more and more information.
Benjamin Arrett is the author of Elements of Taste, Understanding What We Like and Why. And by the way, did you know that the actor who portrays Mrs. Maisel, Rachel Brosnahan, was born in Milwaukee? Our conversation with Benjamin got us wondering, which one of his taste categories would Beta fit into? Sweet? Sour? Salty? Bitter? Umami? Let us know. Just send us an email to beta@wpr.org or tweet us at @WPRBeta. That does it for this edition of Beta. Hear it again or binge on past episodes by subscribing to the Beta podcast on iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite artisanal small batch podcasts. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Our technical director and music director is Steve Gotch.
Small, thin, kind of nice-looking bird.
No, tall, husky, ugly-looking bird.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Hey, maybe he's in his office locked in the John again.
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
He's a playboy who's not having any fun.